going to press record. We're rolling. Jeff, can I get a sound check?
Sure. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Stand by one more time.
Testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Okay, I had the mics reversed, but now I got it.
Okay.
We're live. Eric Andrews Lang Show in... why don't you tell us where we are?
We are technically in the city of Los Angeles, but we are almost on close to the border of Beverly Hills. It's called Holmby Hills.
Right.
It's a very famous neighborhood to real estate agents because it's one of the, if not the most expensive zip codes on the planet Earth for homes that are here.
And we're doing
And calling them homes is probably a bit of an understatement. It's probably not fair. They're mega mansions.
Seriously large. I mean, are you good, Colt?
I'm good. I'm just dialing it in.
For those of you listening to the pod in your car, Jeff and I are on a park bench. This is an absolute first, maybe for any podcast in the world. I don't know. Have you ever done a podcast on a park bench?
I have not.
No,
I have not.
I haven't either. We're getting the cameras ready. So if you're on YouTube, just slowly you're going to see the cameras fade in here. This one's not set up. But what's interesting is we're in, I think, I can't tell whether it's more golf course or more park.
It's park these days. It used to be a little bit more golf course. They're not quite maintaining it like they used to. So it's park.
Yeah.
Most of the users are dog walkers and people chilling out and pondering life and or driving by on Beverly Glen and stopping off and going for a walk because they don't want to sit on the Canyon Road for 20 minutes and not move.
I wonder if the presence of golf in such a casual manner has in some way taken part in people's becoming interested in golf in the first place.
I would hope so. I know in the past that was the case, and when the flag sticks are out here, it really gets your eye, like, oh, holy cow, you could play golf at a place like this, and then you see people out having fun, and you often see a lot of parents with kids. This is a great place to just come out and drop a bunch of balls and not worry about too much. I mean, you don't want to get out near the edge of the golf holes with a little four-year-old taking a full swing, but...
We're on like a triangle of property. We made a video about it, so that'll come out probably the day before or after this podcast. But, you know, it's like this little sliver of property. It's the tenderloin of grass here in Beverly Hills.
Right. And it's always described to people as the back of the range of L.A. Country Club. And they always go, wait, so there's a course attached? No. There's a fence and there's a road. But it's this park that's got two lawn bowling courts. It's got a playground up at the other end. It's a traditional park, other than the fact that it's been here since the 20s. It has this amazing design heritage of the Olmsted brothers creating this as part of this real estate development. And then you have the world-famous Aaron Spelling Mansion overlooking the course, which is, at one point it was the most expensive home ever sold in the United States. I don't know if it still is. There are a couple up, you know, in the hills right now for $250 if those sell. But it was a major project for him building it. Of course, now all the mansions look like that, but at the time it was reviled.
Yes.
And then just to the west of us is UCLA.
Right.
Which is why I told you, Corey Pavin and the UCLA guys used to come and goof off over here and play golf, and work on their short games because it's really close to the campus.
So you are, I guess you do a lot of things, but we could sum you up most briefly as saying you're a journalist within golf. Would you say that that's true?
Sure. Although I don't even like journalists a whole lot because I have very strong opinions. So when people bitch and moan about something I write, and as a journalist, you're supposed to be more balanced than that. And I go,
wait,
well,
is that true?
Oh, I get that all. What do you mean?
But is that true? Are you supposed to be balanced as a journalist?
Yeah,
I think
the term journalist I associate with somebody who's a reporter, who is a somebody who compiles information and writes a story and tries to present both sides of a story if there are two sides. Whereas I have a blog and I for 15 years now almost I've had that and I have my opinions on that and I don't have an editor, which is dangerous, and then but I do write straightforward stories for Golf Week still, and so when I do write those I do get pushback and I mean my views are well known. It's always kind of comical when people are like, why are you you need to have an open mind about the distance issue. It's like, I wrote a book about it, I've ran it and raved, I'm not gonna come around or present the balanced both sides argument for you. I'm coming from it as somebody who has views and has experience that either in golf course design or watching the game change. And those are my opinions. It's not a big deal.
So a bit of a curveball in the interview here. As an interviewer and an interviewee, is there a question that you wish people would ask you more?
Not that I'm aware of, but I'll get back to you. Let me think about that.
Well, you know, I mean, is there something that, or what do you dislike being asked?
Why are you so bitter about distance and the ball going too far? I still get that all the time on Twitter, and it's very simple. It's not done because I like attention and I like upsetting the people at Titleist or the people at TaylorMade or the people at Callaway. I don't do it to get attention. It's not any fun getting all the pushback. Well, you want to take my 5 yards away? And I'm like, oh, do we have to explain this again? And you do. The nice thing that's happened is that a lot of different forces in golf have kind of combined to make people better aware of what really matters to the game.
Mm-hmm.
And so this pursuit of distance is a nice thing. It's one thing. It's something that golfers have always done, but it shouldn't be everything there is about golf. And
right.
And more people are aware of that. And then they're aware of some of the negative elements of lengthening courses and all that kind of stuff. So
right.
The cost.
Because that's the unfortunate result of a ball that goes further is golf courses are less playable. They need to spend a lot more money in making them longer.
Yeah, that was the main reason when I started bitching and moaning about it in about 1998. Now, you know, people well before me, Alistair McKenzie, Jack Nicklaus, I mean, the list is very long, Bobby Jones, have all seen this, but now it's on an expedited path where we've just seen unbelievable jumps in recent years. So I sit back still and watch a lot of the debates of late. They've been kind of interesting on Twitter with Brandel Chamblee changing his point of view and coming in that it's athleticism and it's athletes. And that's really a marketing-driven thing. Not, maybe not for Brandel, but the tour and a lot of the entities, and you've, I'm sure, seen this kind of in your time now in golf. There's a constant need to overcompensate for what golf is. And so in the case of the distance thing, it's like, oh, we're excited. It's exciting. We've got some athletes. We've got to just drive home this athletes narrative because that makes us more cool that our guys are athletes. There are no NFL scouts out at PGA Tour events looking to sign pro golfers, okay? They are in better shape. They have amazing people around them that have figured out the things you need to do to be stronger, to take advantage of the equipment, all that stuff. They are, but they are not triathletes. They are not what people are trying to make them out to be. And it's on the list of many things where golf is overcompensating because they're trying to appease marketing people who are trying to make the game cooler and seem cooler and younger and all this stuff. And it's just fake.
Right.
The overcompensation thing. So I'm getting off on a tangent. But so the distancing has so many levels now of issues and opinions and people coming at it from different points of view.
What if they just made all the fairways really, really soggy?
Well, that's been, yeah, we've had all those suggestions. We've tried the narrowing arrow. It became bomb and gouge golf. We have had people claiming that the boost in distance the last few years has been for more roll, and it's not. Their shot link tracks roll.
Right.
And it's just, anyway, it's an ongoing thing, and it's going to continue. It's going to really be a big deal this year in golf.
You seem to be a person who's willing to think differently, do things differently, say different things. Does that tie into what might be the hardest part of your job? I don't know. What is the hardest part of your job?
That's the hardest part of the job, in that the world of golf is so sensitive and so not into opinions that are anything but whatever the current kind of marketing-driven theme is. And so it being such a conservative sport and one that is uncomfortable with analysis and opinion, that it makes the job more difficult of what I do, because you just spend a lot of time dealing with drama and histrionics over things that you just want to say, you do know this is golf. We are not covering the White House here. We are not covering climate change. Well, sometimes every once in a while we do, but you need to step back and understand part of the fun of being in golf is debate and debating topics and debating golf courses and debating why that guy played that shot or why in the hell are people still wearing white belts or whatever it is.
Should white belts be illegal?
I am firmly on the record about white belts. I began a crusade after Marty Hackle. I took it to a different level on our Jackhouse pod, and I'm proud to say that I feel like the white belt thing has finally is starting to go away. The next phase will be white shoes, as I'm looking at you wearing white shoes. The only places in society where you see people wearing white belts and white shoes are in golf or at a Pat Boone backyard cocktail party. Drinks cocktail parties.
Is Pat New Boone? Year's Eve?
I don't know. Pat's pretty religious. He may not be having a party with cocktails. But
why no white shoes?
No, white shoes are fine. It's the white shoes that look like nurses' shoes and the white shoes with the black pants and the navy blue pants where the tour pro. It's like companies make some shoes that are just some different colors, okay?
Sure.
That's all. My position is not nearly as strong on the white shoes as it is on the white belt.
What is it about the white belt? Is it for
it
you?
Just screams Pat. Now I'm old enough to remember that era of people wearing white belts and Sansa belts and again, you don't see people wearing that anywhere else in the world. So it's like, yeah. I understand. It's your way to say, hey, I'm a golfer. I'm wearing a 4-inch thick white belt. But it's just...
Maybe it goes back to the Open.
My view is that golf fashion is best when you wear something that when you leave the course, nobody necessarily knows you're a golfer.
I agree.
And I think that's when something's really successful as a piece of clothing or shoes or whatever it is. And... that's all. That's my barometer. I like the idea. Or maybe you wear a shirt that's tucked in because you go play a nice course, but then on the way out, you untuck it and the shirt looks cool and you look more relaxed and you don't look like you just walked off the course. That's all. To me, it's just a way to, and I think we've seen a shift in fashion that way.
Well, no, the ironic thing is that golf is such a casual social game, but it doesn't involve a specific uniform like softball or baseball or anything like that, or bowling. And so then when you do go out in the world in your golf outfit, you make golf look bad.
I think so, especially when it's really gaudy and really the full on. And then, of course, you always see the people who forget to take the glove out of the back pocket. Which
Ooh, that's a good one.
I always laugh at that. I always go, tap them on the shoulder as a fellow golfer and go, because I know they don't intend to walk around in the real world.
How often? I haven't seen it that often. You see it very often?
Just every once in a while. You just randomly see somebody at the Trader Joe's, or I've seen somebody multiple times at the racetrack at Santa Anita. I've seen that guy in the betting window, and you go, ooh, I need to go tell him. You can't have the glove in the back pocket. It's great you played golf this morning and you came over to the track, but now you need to put it away.
So have you spent... how much of your life would you say consciously have you spent thinking about golf?
Probably most of it. I mean, I started drawing golf holes in class and as a young kid. Like a lot of, it's a very strange thing. My granddad and my dad played golf, but I was one of those people who started drawing golf holes. I think it's about 5 or 6. I was doing that before I even played, and then really did it a lot as I kind of got teased by the game, tagging along like most people because it was fun to drive the cart kind of thing.
And where was that? Where did you grow up?
Well, believe it or not, here in Southern California. Yeah. And the golf course where I first tagged along with my dad and granddad was Valencia Country Club, which was a public course at the time, surrounded by nothing. And if you
right
go there now,
the five,
of course,
right?
Yeah, right off the freeway, and it was
on
just
the other side of TPC.
Correct.
It's the sort of less hilly course, the more reasonable to create course.
Yeah. And it was a public course for a long time, and then it was turned into a private golf course, and I have a picture of me out there with one of those carts that looked like Dwight Eisenhower used, you know, with the big bar.
Oh, yeah, the three-wheeler.
And in the background, you see nothing, and that is all malls and homes now in Santa Clarita. Whoa. Yeah, it just blows your mind when you think that wasn't that long ago. And then DeBell Golf Course, where my granddad played quite a bit there, and then kind of in the city of L.A., and then my dad worked for American Golf Corporation, so I traveled with him a lot and saw a lot of golf courses, and that's kind of why I started getting into golf course design and questioning why people did what they did. And then he joined Riviera
Were you a bit
16.
Of a punk as a kid? Like, not I can't see you being as a punk as far as like style goes, but.
No.
But when you say questioning, were you kind of a smart aleck in that way as far as questioning why things were a certain way?
Yeah.
Most great thinkers are.
Yeah, I mean, that's how you get good, at what you do, that you have there's something that you ingrained in you or that you've picked up that makes you question why is that done that way? Why do they mow that hole that way? Or why does that bunker look, it just doesn't look right? So I did that a lot. And
do you remember some of your early?
I just remember looking at a lot of golf holes and trying to think how I would have designed them differently. I think every golfer does, but I would do it a lot and ponder places where, or more commonly, pieces of land that you would see, and you just see a golf hole, and you go, "Oh my God, wouldn't that be the most amazing?"
Like dreaming.
I mean, there's so many people that I've heard from. I wrote a little novel about Alistair McKenzie, and it pains me to read it now. I mean, everything you write, you're pained. But the one thing, I created a fictional golf course on the land that if you just drove by it, I think you just sat in a monster traffic jam on the 5.
Yes.
All that Camp Pendleton land.
Yes.
And every golfer I know in Southern California who's made that drive has looked over there and went, "My God, look at those golf holes!" Because there are ravines and you have the ocean. It's just sort of land that's never been touched other than for military exercises. So, actually, now that I think about it, I did a lot of staring at virgin land and wondering what you could do with it.
And then you met Gil Hance.
I met
or
Gil.
Shovel in the ground days start before that?
I would say no. Actually, project-wise, no. Nothing really before Gil, except one thing. My dad had the Sinaloa golf course in Simi Valley, and we redid the it's a 9-hole par 3, and I redid that with Dave Axelin and Dan Proctor, who were shapers for Coren Crenshaw. Met them when they were working at Riviera. So that was my first actual experience in the ground. But before that, I played college golf at Pepperdine, and I had a lot of interest in all the old architects and reading about the old stuff. My dad had George Thomas's book, which got me going on kind of him and Southern California, and it's an amazing book because it's so visual. There's so many drawings and photos and. It can really get your imagination going more than any of the great books that have been done on course design.
But going back to, how did you meet Gil?
I did a book called The Golden Age of Golf Design. It came out in like 2000. Anyway, when I was working on that, I went back east and was researching. And this was before you could find a lot of these things on the internet, before collections put their photos online. You had to go to the library and go through them, which was fun. I really enjoyed that, kind of the thrill of the hunt of finding these things. And now people are just amazing at what they find and how much has been digitized
right.
by libraries and stuff. So I met him when I was doing that, and he said if a project ever came along and you want to work together, you know, let me know. I'd love to do something. And I knew what, you know, we had the same philosophy, and so. Rustic Canyon came along. The guy who was developing that, my dad worked with at American Golf, and it's a long story. It took a while, although, you know, by Southern California standards, not anything outrageously long when you consider how environmentally sensitive the ground was. And, you know, it just kind of one thing led to another. And I told them when I saw the property, it was amazing and it could be an amazing golf course. And eventually it did, it happened.
And, you know, it's interesting to hear you talk about, you know, in your early years being interested in architecture and George Thomas and all this, all these books. Do you now notice, you know, I only have been learning about golf for the past 7 years and architecture for definitely a fraction of that. Do you notice at some point, well, Andy Johnson calls it architecture, the craft beer of golf. Do you see that trend happening with more and more people becoming interested in the history of the course and the origins and, you know, restorations and things like that?
It's been amazing. I would say, I don't know what, I'm not sure what the breakthrough moment was. I'd probably have to think about that a little bit more. When I first started doing the books and then writing about things for internet publications or magazines, it was a really, it was a tough sell. It was seen as kind of a geeky, wonky area. And I think a lot of that had to do with presentation. Not that I would criticize the people who I started reading, Ron Witten or Brad Klein,
can we just talk about Brad Klein for a second?
Oh, I started listening to that show the other day. Would you like to break off into the Brad Klein conversation? Sure.
I mean, I had to say, you know, I remember meeting him and I was like, wow. You are the definition of curmudgeon.
Oh no, he's
but a
not
sweet
that,
curmudgeon. I mean,
he was crankier than he is. Come on, oh my gosh.
Well, he was just such a wonderful
guy.
He'll
agree with that.
I mean, in a first take kind of way. In the long term, the guy is such a gentle, deeply devoted golf fan.
Well, we're both critics. We're both analysts, and we both have seen a lot of golf courses. He's seen way more than I have, and I've seen a good number. And we've seen mostly crap, mostly really bad stuff, stuff that could be way better, stuff that you look at and you know how much they spent, and you say, WTF. So he's not a curmudgeon. He's just a critic and has a sharp eye.
Yeah, better said.
Ron, I'm a curmudgeon in that I just assume the worst with certain architects, and I'm usually right about that. He'll go into some of those places with a little more of an open mind than I will. That's where we're different. But he knows better. He knows most of them certain people are hacks. But so he was a big part of it. I mean, Ron's been writing about architecture for a long time for Golf Digest, but I think just a few different things, a few forces came together that started making it cool to want to know about the courses. And my point of view has always been people in golf are connoisseurs of this sport. They're obsessed with their clubs, their clothes, their bag. But how is it that they weren't obsessed with the courses, which is the most interesting part? The setting where you play is the most interesting part of the game. And like knowing about a wine or knowing about a cigar or knowing about a car or a watch, your enjoyment is enhanced so much by knowing just the basics of the history, the basics of the design, or going in with a little bit of an eye like, it's kind of fun to be an armchair architect and analyze this and complain about it or debate what you would do to make a hole better. And it just blew my mind that more golfers, like the architecture part was the not something that they thought about. It's like, well, wait, that's the coolest part of the sport. And you know, the thing to me about it's an art form. But it's the most interesting art form and form of architecture because it combines landscape architecture, engineering, agronomy, and then to get a course built, there's a business side, there's a political story you have to deal with, whether it's a club or a municipality. you have a sports element. This is a sport. Competitions are played on these incredible places. And so it brings together an unbelievable number of things, and it's the only art form where you can sit here and we can sit and look at what's before us, but then you get to step into the painting, the Purple Rose of Cairo, where she's sitting there watching the Woody Allen movie, and then she, the guy keeps noticing her, and she steps into the movie. And in golf, you get to step onto this work of art, hopefully. Most of them aren't masterpieces, sadly, but I think what's fun, what you're doing and a lot of other people are doing, is realizing that it doesn't have to be a masterpiece to still go in and appreciate elements of it.
Yeah.
There are very few places where every inch of the place is just perfectly done and you go, my God, that is no detail was missed. That's incredible. It's very hard to do that and then maintain it. But it's still fun if a place just has moments and enough work and character, you can get so much more satisfaction out of that. So it's been really fun to see that, and it's just a combination of things that have gone on from people who did books like myself and people who talked about it to high definition,
yeah,
to YouTube. You just can go on and on. Now Instagram to me is really sort of driving home the architecture that I like, because it, let's be honest, it's more visually appealing on a form, on a Instagram feed, either a story, somebody telling you a story about a course, or a photograph that's been enhanced a little. Reese Jones courses just don't pop on Instagram.
Right.
But Coren Crenshaw courses do. And then they're also really fun to play.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, a lot of people talk about golf and, at least the quotes from competitive golfers of our time will say, yeah, I'm not playing against the other golfers. I'm playing against the course. It's interesting to then go out as an amateur and with a blind eye to the designer or the logic of the design or the placement of the hazards or the defense that the course has. You sort of get into that. That's almost I don't know. It's like the second book or the eighth book or whatever books you're reading golf, the Encyclopedia of Golf. It's the ultimate phase. It's the next level, And it's interesting for me because my experience has been is it recontextualizes what I thought I knew or the courses that I liked, and I can go back now and see Roosevelt, for example. It's like, oh wow, like. Here's why this is interesting, or here's why this is like, this is not a hole you see very often. Yeah. Number eight, for example. What do you think of number eight at Roosevelt?
Scariest tee shot on the planet Earth, is it not? I mean, I don't know how it's looking right now, but the last time I played it, it's just frightening. It's just so tight.
Yeah, there's no end in sight.
Yeah.
Strangely.
But I love it. I love the places. I've just recommended somebody who was staying downtown for a trip, and they wanted a golf course within Uber range, and I said, well, it's a really bizarre place in a good way. It's kind of fun, and the Griffith Observatory's there, and you got the Greek Theater, it's right in the heart of the city. It's just, there's nothing quite like it. It's not a masterpiece, but it's a fun place. It could be a really fun place with a little bit of minor work, I think, but that you can say that for a lot of places. But to what you're saying, that to me is one of the fun things of being a golfer. And is that kind of being able to give a course a critical eye. But back to what I was saying earlier, it's such a sensitive sport. It's such a conservative sport that you have to be so careful not to offend your guests or your hosts and remember.
Do you have a story about this?
Well, no, it's really been something. I mean, if you go back and read C.B. McDonald, he says, like, criticizing somebody's golf course is like going into his family and, saying, well, the middle daughter is not a looker. It's horrible. It's mean to people. It really hurts them.
Yeah. I wonder why. Why do you think?
Well, you get to know, and McKenzie wrote about this, it's your home course. You get to know every little bump. And if you, at some point, you convince yourself this is your happy place, and it may not be an architectural masterpiece, but you enjoy being there, you enjoy the people, You're comfortable there, and so you then kind of turn the course into something maybe a little better than it is. So when somebody comes and goes, hey, are you guys going to cut down some trees here so we can actually see the views or whatever it is? You know, they go right. All Rodney on them and come in and go, you know, it's what's going on here? And it's sort of a wake-up call, and people don't take it as well. But, again, that's changed a little bit. I think that people are increasingly aware that it's fun to have opinions about course design, and it's certainly shaping the way players pick schedules on the PGA Tour, how people plan trips.
They say, like, I don't like to play that course.
Yeah. I mean, or I don't like to play Reese Jones courses, or I don't like to play...
are there a lot of Reese Jones courses on tour?
There were for a while. They're increasingly fewer as the PGA Tour's architectural IQ has gone up.
Are you just sort of waiting to see one of your favorites come up on tour? Like a Cor Crenshaw? Is that even possible?
Well, no. There have been some magnificent places that... I mean, I just wrote a piece for Golf Week. Kind of the most intriguing venues this year. La Hinch is hosting the Irish Open.
Whoa.
And like the last place on the planet Earth you'd ever think you'd see pro
golf.
Isn't that
like 6,500 yards?
Yeah, and they're crisscrossing holes and there's sheep everywhere.
Whoa.
It's going to be incredible.
Are you going to go to that?
It's 2 weeks before the Open. I'm kind of trying to figure out how to get over there.
It would be so unusual.
Even just the weekend. It's going to be bizarre. Because they went to Gullin twice for the Scottish, which was pretty courageous. But still, well, realistic as a golf course, but, you know, trying to get people there and dealing with a little two-lane road.
Right.
And it was sensational, and the guys loved it, and they had a great time. There are places like that. I can't believe, you know, Cruden Bay, the European Tour looked at, would have been incredible for the world to see that. But so we've been doing that now the last few years. Detroit Golf Club's going to host the tour event this year. There's some places that are... There's just more and more tours realizing architecture sells things a little bit more. It's another story to tell.
Right.
It's one that keeps the players happy because the players are more appreciative of good design than they've ever been, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, they still get mad about features because they're in their way. They're trying to shoot the lowest score possible. So it's a combination of elements. Jeff Ogilvie was a big influence on that. Zach Blair has been a huge influence. So there are players more and more who are embracing these places, and then it just helps that there are a lot of people in golf who are more aware, so they're taking tournaments to places where they should, where it really is great, where architecture, and it just changes the whole vibe of a tournament. And you know, most of the great places there have the scale is more intimate,
right?
The vibe of the place is just feels good. Doesn't yeah. feel fake and manufactured, and all those little things you can't—they're intangibles that just translate to a better experience.
Let's go to a quick break here, and then get a couple of commercials out of the way. All right, folks, you know my favorite golf shoe, don't you? I think you do. It's Three Stripe Life, y'all, and that means Adidas. And so, anyway, I just wanted to tell you that when I'm a big fan of the Tour 360, obviously. And they've made a huge update to the Tour 360, and the two letters that it's concerned with are the letters X and T, okay? The Tour 360 XT changes the game, okay? It's lighter, so your feet feel even better after a round. By the way, a light golf shoe is what I'm all about. There are some other companies making heavy golf shoes, and I'm just like, by the way, I weigh enough. There's enough going on. I'm carrying a golf bag. I'm carrying my team. Tour XT changes the game. It's lighter, so your feet feel even better after a round, and it still features that Boost, y'all. Do you know where Boost comes from? And Boost is cool because it only comes in black and white. I don't know if you noticed that. And actually, the guy who made Boost like was going to bring it to some other, you know, they were shopping it around, and everyone else said no. Adidas was like, I'll take that Boost, even though it's only black and white. And what did Adidas do with it? They made it awesome. I'm looking at Boost right now on my feet. Boost on my feet. And it has an X-shaped traction system that gives you insane stability. Literally, it's not sane. It's literally crazy. Your feet will literally be like, I'm crazy. Best part, it comes in spikeless. Ooh, that's tight. The first spikeless ever in the history of the Tour 360. Crazy comfortable and perfect for the course. Get your pair at adidas.com. Thank me later. Follow Adidas Golf for all the latest and greatest. That's all true statements right there. Check it out. Go support Adidas because they're a good company, good people. All right, later. Oh, right. We're back. Thank you. I'm curious to know, for those listening, I try to imagine the people listening don't know what La Hinch is. Can you explain La Hinch? I had the wonderful fortune of playing that first on my trip to Ireland.
Wow.
And so that was a true, and I played with a local who had been a member there forever. Can you explain a little bit about what makes La Hinch so special? I'm going to take a nap.
Well, no. I'm not going to. It's been a long time since I was at La Hinch. So that's part of the reason I'm sort of excited to get acquainted with it again. My dad and I went there. Ronald Reagan was near the end of his presidency. So it's a Lynx. It's a beautiful property. It's a little more unusual than the standard Lynx. It's a little more severe. It has a blind par three, just a straight blind hole. It has crisscrossing fairways. It's as bizarre a place as you can get, I think, in golf in terms of architecture. Just breaking all the rules, following no guidelines whatsoever. It could never be built today.
No,
I hate that cliche, but it's just true. It just if you tried to do that, I mean, I've seen a few things where. The Buck Club has a few elements like that, and Tom Doakes, I think, got a few elements like that, maybe on a thing he's proposed at Sand Valley, but nothing like La Hinch. Nobody would even dare, don't think. And that's fine. I mean, it's just there. It just takes what was there, and then some people obviously nudged it like the old course. They said, well, this just isn't working, and we have to make it better, and they added elements to make it a little more feasible for golf.
It's old Tom, right?
Yeah, and then McKenzie had some.
Oh, I didn't realize
McKenzie had a hand in it. He had a little bit of a modification role, so it'll be fun to watch.
It's such a my experience of playing there was it's such a dark green maze of golf and hills, even though it's on just the Lynx land. It's like right off the beach, but it's just so hilly and extreme. There were times where the ball was like 3 feet below my foot.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's why a lot of people hate it, because it is extreme.
I actually eagled that hole, the fourth hole, the par five. Is that right? Fourth hole, sixth hole, seventh hole? Anyway, the ball was there, and I normally would have been like, oh, get me the fuck out of here. This is ridiculous. hit a pretty mediocre second shot from a hard lie and then chipped in for eagle. So you never know.
You never know.
Have you had a hole-in-one on a course you've designed?
Well, have I?
Yes.
No. This is another thing that has changed a lot in recent years with architecture, where people just could not separate their bias based on their score, or what they perceive to be an unfair break or bounce, and so we've seen more people are able to kind of step back and assess a place without. Thinking about their round and how they played. I still, when I really want to see a new course, I prefer not to play it. I prefer to, if I'm really serious about studying the design and writing an article and all that about it, because even, it's just very hard to first take in a course that has a lot going on.
Yeah.
Like Trinity Forest last year that debuted on the tour, Coren Crenshaw, it's easily their best design in terms of taking... a very nothing site, except for a few moments, and really creating something special. And I wanted to, was glad I couldn't play it because I was there on Monday of a tour event, and so I could just start walking it and taking it in. But it's exciting to me that, because so many conversations I used to have about course design would be, oh, I love that place. I had the best round of my life there. And it's like, yeah, but it's boring, it's bad, but you can't say that. And so I don't hear that as much anymore. Or the day we played, the greens sucked, but it could be good. I just couldn't tell, the greens were so bad. Like, people say that less now because they just have a greater awareness that conditioning ebbs and flows, or it's not all about them.
Right. So, because it's two different things. And Brad Klein talked about this. He won't play it if he's rating.
Right. No, I know.
So do you, I mean, that's tough. I mean, how do you see that? Do you ever get involved in course rating? It's all BS anyway.
Yeah, it is. I was one time on the Golf Week panel, and I mean, they're not entirely BS. The ratings have been good for raising awareness of architecture, but where they're...
But it should be like an A, a B, a C, and a D, and that's all the top 100.
Yeah, they've gotten carried away with the criteria. I mean, look at the Golf Digest list that just came out, and it's got the same problem it always has every year, or every 2 years. It is about experience, difficulty, and good conditioning too much. And
right.
They're not... And so you have places on the list where you just go, are you kidding me? Nobody in their right mind would want to play that course every day. And you have it ranked there. And then you go back and some of these places have just fought. They pop on the list high and then they fall out of favor. And I would love to see what their panel comes up with if you could take away. I mean, resistance to scoring is a category. Which is like rating a book by how many pages it is, or how long, rating a movie by how long it is,
yeah.
Or rating an album by oh, it's a triple album. Well, great. He emptied his, you know, his notebook on. But is it a great album? Is it tight? Is it, you know, is every song work together, or has it got a bunch of crap in the middle that weighs it down? And it's absurd to celebrate how hard a course is. Anybody can design a golf course that's unplayable. That is not a skill. So
right.
And then conditioning is just tough because some people will go to a place and they aerify the greens and you're gonna ding them for that, and I'm sure they do.
Yeah.
So it's gotten carried away with the criteria. I like the criteria that Golf Week uses because it asks people to think about things, but it doesn't actually hold you to adding up all those scores and then that being the score for the course. So, but you're right. It probably, you know, it should just be kind of A, B, C, D. And it's just very hard for people to separate experience from architecture. I just had this long conversation with some people, you know, and I don't want to say on the pod, but that.
Why? Because you don't want to, or because you don't think I want you to?
I just don't want to. It's not important. That's really the reason. And it. But I'm
sure I love them.
You do. I love the idea of. I love the idea of lists to generate discussion. So
okay.
They are beneficial in that way. And I'd actually love to see more lists. You know, the top 100 experiences, vibes.
I was thinking of a list: the top 100 worst courses you can play.
That would be tough. There would not be a lot of magazines that would like to do that at this point because the hate mail would be excessive.
How does working for a magazine must suck? Because you can't really say anything that goes outside the scope of the advertisers.
Yeah, that's where I have my blog.
Boom. Shaq goes outside the box.
That's where the blog's always been nice. Yeah. I mean,
do you get advertisers on the blog?
I don't. It's,
really?
It's no. It's been kind of a. It's never been. I did it. I did a book called The Future of Golf in 2004.
Would you say that's one of your best works?
Well, it's no, not in the sense of that you'd give it as a gift book, but I think it's an important book because I kind of got into all the reasons that we don't want to stretch out golf courses and we don't want to do all these different things, and we need to get our values sort of back in line with what really ultimately makes it fun to go out and play a round of golf.
Real quick, what is the book someone should read if they haven't read anything of yours yet?
The Future of Golf.
There you go. All right. That's what I was getting at. There you go.
Grounds for Golf is my primer on architecture book, which may come back into print, actually. It's in ebook form.
Okay. Grounds for Golf.
If you go play Cypress Point, the Cypress Point book's probably the best book I've done in terms of, and I didn't do any of the work. It was this amazing photographer named Graham and this amazing architect named McKenzie and the other guy named Hunter, and they photographed the course in its pristine state, and we just put it together as an album of sorts. And
cool.
The Future of Golf was what started my blog. When I started the website, the word blog was just kind of starting.
Interesting.
To kind of come into play. Yeah, I'm old. And so I started doing posts, like trying to do one a day, following up, documenting things that I written about in the book. And then that became a blog, and then blogs started to become a big deal. And so it's been the one thing I've always been able to do that I mean, there are days where it's like, I don't want to deal with the website. But then there are days where it's just so fun, where there's stories where I just love, and I'm my own boss. I can do whatever I want. And Golf Week picks up some of my blog posts sometimes as part of my arrangement with them, which is always fun for me to see, like, oh, you guys liked that post. Oh, okay. And it's like, and sometimes it's, hey, how come you didn't pitch that to us? Like, well, I did it at 10 o'clock and you guys were all in bed. And
right.
And I didn't think you'd want to see me ranting and raving about a 16-year-old girl who's in a Nike ad Apple ad blatantly breaking the amateur status rules. I didn't think you'd want that, that kind of thing. So that's how that evolved. The site was a follow-up to that book.
Right.
And so I've struggled with it, and now I'm, you know, like, now I don't even know what to do, because so I've just kind of gone to, because it got to where I would spend a lot of time on it. I'd aggregate a lot of content and do roundups from majors. Well, now I'm at a major and I'm covering it for Golf Channel and Golf Week. I barely have time to do a couple posts, and I feel bad. But then now there are a lot of other people doing cool stuff where I feel like it lacks, and where I've time has sort of passed me by. And thankfully there's people like you and Andy doing the Fried Egg, doing great content. I do lament that I'm not doing more architecture stuff with the drones and kind of showing you golf courses. But there's just only so many hours in the day, and so I really enjoy what I'm doing with the people who are paying me. So there's
they
also
are the
that.
Top priority.
The podcasting, you know, has gone really well with Shack House, but even that, it's like, I love what you're doing with interviews. You need to keep doing that.
Thank you.
The interviews are vital, because there are a lot of interesting people out there.
It's endless. And I found that don't take this personally. Well, maybe it's actually you're in between. But I found that there's actually sometimes an inverse relationship between interesting and famous. So some of the best interviews that I get feedback about that I've done are ones that I was like, wow, no one knows who that is.
Correct. Yeah. No. Yeah. There are a lot of,
you know,
of
like
famous
Jim
people.
Urbina.
Right.
Everyone loved the Jim Urbina. He doesn't even have an Instagram. He is not a personality.
Correct. Yeah. No. And nobody would know that his name outside of the architecture world, and yet he's been involved in some incredible golf courses.
Yeah.
And when you say involved, you know, that's really the difference. You may not be aware of it, but where architecture has changed is somebody like that we do know about, somebody like Jim Urbina, or that you do know my role at Rusta Canyon and working with Gil. It was a star-only business. And it was about this guy who would come out and pose for a photo with rolled-up plans. And that person wouldn't know jack diddly squat if you went into the details of his design. And it was such a, I mean, there were so many people who were just cashing checks.
Yeah.
Putting no, they're just soulless designs, no love, no attention to detail into what they were doing. And so now what's cool is the model that Corn Crenshaw created of shapers and kind of, starting with a design and then modifying as you go has sort of made stars out of all these other people who we knew existed, with Alistair McKenzie and George Thomas and Billy Bell and all these people, but we don't really know their names. We know a few of their names. So that is another thing that just sort of has raised awareness of how much goes into a design, how many hours Jim Urbina spends on site, how much time is spent quibbling over features. But that's how the great courses are built, just like you guys in the editing room or any form of art. People in music, how much time they spend in doing the finish work and the editing and the mixing, and how you know, a couple moves one way or another are the difference between making a song timeless and permanent or something that everybody forgets. So it's such a responsibility with course design to do that. And so the people like me and Brad, who are bitter at times about when you see something where they had a great property and they didn't take the time to get all the details right for something that theoretically is going to last for 100 years, it offends your sensibility, you know?
Do you learn more from a course that you love or more from a course that you don't love?
I think I learn more from a course I love or I know is a great course, and I get to go see it again with a fresh eye. Like I've had a chance to see the old course a decent amount the last few years, and you see something. You know, the great course is you see something new every time.
What did you take away from the old course?
Oh, I'm
single most important thing.
Single most important thing.
Got
that's
him.
Tough.
Got him.
Well, there's just
that
so
it's
many...
old. Don't say that
no,
it's
no,
old.
No. That well, one, the it's a different place. The ground is different. I'm not one to get all mystical, but
it sounds like you're going there.
The turf there is just, there's just something different with the grass. I mean, they put that stuff, that place through hell, and it looks great all the time. It's unbelievable how that turf is. I took a divot last time I was there, and it still looks great. It's dried up, but it looks great. There's something going on there. Again, I'm not into all that. Golf in the Kingdom guy. I am not doing Shivas Iron stuff. It's fine. I love all. And by the way, that had an influence on this movement too. Another thing, Michael Bamberger wrote a book, To the Lynx Land. There's like all these little Lauren Rubenstein. All these little things kind of have come together. Shivas Irons has been another thing that kind of got people in tune with certain elements of the game that are important. So no, I don't mock it. I'm not into like the mystical stuff in the middle of the night. But it's just the ground there is so amazing. You can't replicate the contours.
No.
But I guess the main thing is that the possibilities are so infinite with the way it plays every day. And so that's my thing with most golf courses is that they're very predictable after a couple of playings. And the greatest ones just never get old. And you've just got to keep injecting things that make a course just give you just little surprises every day. That's
right.
Really the key.
Do you
the
have
great
any,
architecture.
Yeah. Do you have any advice for new golfers?
In terms of...
Can you help him out with his boom arm here? It's kind of help him get it up.
I think it looks like... Yeah.
It's kind of...
Yeah, thank you. Help me get it up,
there you
Cole.
Go.
Thank you.
right before the end of the interview. That's good.
In terms of what?
You meet someone who's just playing golf and they say, do you have any advice for me? They just started. You meet them on their first round, and they say, well, "Jeff, you're a pioneer. You've spent as you said, the majority of your life thinking about golf. Do you have any advice for me?"
But they have some idea what they're doing, or they're new golfer. They're just taking up the game.
They've made. Let's see. I'm going to come up with this person. This person has maybe played 10 rounds of golf.
Okay.
They don't watch it on TV.
They don't. Okay.
But not because of any reason. They just don't. They have caught the bug, but they are yet to fully divest the core of their being into the game of golf. Perhaps they are, trepidatious for a certain reason.
Yeah.
How would you basically...
I just had this conversation with somebody,
push
actually.
Push them down the slope of golf.
I said, just keep going to the range and understand that makes you a golfer. You're a golfer now. Because one of the things that has always been so obnoxious about our sport... and again, it's sort of, this is changing, thankfully. Again, people like you and a lot of different people exposing that this is not vital. That the idea was to be a golfer, you had to have this full set of new clubs. You play 18 holes. You know, you're always playing 18. You're not just a person who goes to the range or whatever. And all these ridiculous things that intimidated people from playing the sport, including, you know, you have to be a member of a club to be a golfer. I mean, all that's just crap. So I always just tell people, just go to the range, get comfortable. And then when you really are starting to kind of get the itch, you know, go out. And go to casual places. Don't worry about, you know, what the reputation is. It's just about getting out there and whapping it around and just getting a feel, because it can be overwhelming. There's a lot going on, and there's a lot of stuff with etiquette. And you're a golfer. That's what I love about Top Golf, is that it's just another entry point to kind of just chop away at some of these stupid barriers. And then the other thing I keep telling them is just understand that even the best players in the world have been completely humiliated by the game. And people who play a lot, it's so humiliating. It just absolutely just ruins you at times. And understand that's just part of the sport. Everybody's been there, so remember that when you're nervous or you're the first time you're going to a really nice course, just understand, you know, just that's how the game is. It's cruel, and don't get discouraged, and don't let anybody make you think that you know it's this amazing thing every time, because sometimes it's not. It's tough.
Do you your place in golf now? You referred to there's dogs all over this park. It's amazing.
They're listening. He's listening in on the interview in his Christmas sweater. He's yeah. enjoying this conversation. He's pretending he's not listening, but he really is listening.
There's a couple now. Three-legged dogs hanging out. I think between them, they got about six. He's got four. I didn't see that.
Yeah, he's four. He's good.
But you referred to this idea of don't get nervous the first time you go to a nice course, and you brought me back.
Well, I'm saying try not to. I mean, you will be. It's intimidating.
That's not my point. My point is that you brought me back to a time in my life when I would get nervous to play a nice course, and I was actually saying yesterday to someone, if I got an invite to Pine Valley, I might not hit the range. I might just show up on the first tee and be like, let's go. Whereas that would be inconceivable back in... Sorry, Princess Bride. that would be inconceivable to beginner golf guy Eric when I would go play TPC Valencia and literally hit two buckets of balls.
Right, and you picked out your outfit the night before, yeah, and you ironed your golf towel. And
The golf towel. So where are you at with that? I mean, you played everywhere you wanted to play? What is left for you to explore? What is golf to you now? Do you care? Where do you want to go?
Yeah, actually, I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to ask you about this. You touched on something in the show after you played Bel Air where you're kind of renouncing your interest in clubs. Were you a member at Wilshire?
Yes, for 3 years.
Okay, and you're not now?
Correct.
And you gave it up?
I gave it up voluntarily, yeah.
They didn't kick you out. Okay. Just want to clarify. Yeah.
No.
They didn't. So
it's a valid question.
No. Well, I mean, hey, I you don't know this, but I can only go on so I wrote a book on Riviera.
Yeah.
I wrote a book on George Thomas.
Uh-huh.
I'm the world expert on George Thomas. But I wrote a commentary in 2002 when Tom Fazio just butchered the golf course.
Sure.
As he
would.
And it's gone, long gone. It was on golfobserver.com. You cannot find the thing. It was good, though. I got in some good jabs. Anyway, they didn't like that. I am forbidden from the property at Riviera, except 1 week a year to cover the tournament there.
You could go in under a stage name?
Yeah, probably. The
Chef Jackalford?
I could put on a little bit of an outfit and yeah. So I can't remember why I got on Riviera.
Wilshire.
Oh, okay, yes. So yeah. Wilshire, so you're not banned me at Riviera. Okay.
No, I actually came back as a guest.
I'm the only person probably in the history of the world to be banned from a golf course for a piece of architectural criticism. Which, by the way, was well-founded because everybody still goes to the eighth hole and goes, what is this disaster? So you've just decided that club life is not for you. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, it was an analysis of time and money, right? I don't have a lot of time, and I don't have a lot of money.
Okay.
So why would I? And then on the other side of that equation, on the top of it is, I love new things. I was actually in the bathroom here. We took a break from filming. And
okay. They're a little bleak here these days at Holmby Park.
Well, what's funny is I walked in the bathroom and I first thought, this is such a nice bathroom. And then I thought, geez, I'm so glad. Because here's the thing. If I had still been a member of Wilshire, we probably would have gone and played there.
Right, right.
And I actually went to the bathroom here and I thought, this is such a nice bathroom. I'm so glad we're not at Wilshire.
Yeah, okay.
Because here we get to experience something new.
Yeah.
And you've really done me a favor, a service by bringing me here and inviting me to something new. I mean, it's sad to me to think that you would play the same places over and over and over because merely financial reasons.
Sure.
And so for me, I don't make quite enough to be a member of Wilshire and never play there.
Right.
I need to play there.
Right.
So that was why I left.
Okay.
Is because I wanted to experience the world.
Okay. Well, here we are. I'm in a little different place I'm kind of over the club.
Yeah.
Golf is a clubby sport. It's gotten clubbier. And with all the great things that are going on, taste-wise and vibe-wise, and your Goat Hill parks and your Winter Park Nines, which are just, you know, the thing. Those are the things that give me the most hope. We don't have anything like that in L.A. We were just talking with Evan before the show. We've got to get that at these amazing facilities we have here that are so run down and should be, with just not that much work, nice places to go. Like, I live not that far from Penmar. I just have no desire to go down there.
It's a lawn.
And it's not...
Penmar's a lawn.
So the golf course is a lawn. But again, sometimes you just, you know, it's a beautiful afternoon. You just want to go hit some shots and play any... I love evening golf. I hate playing golf before noon. I love evening golf.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, the best time of day.
It's the cheapest.
Cheapest.
It's backwards.
And most of the time, it's the time when courses are the quietest, and you're always just blown away. Like, this is the nicest time of day to play. The grass isn't wet. The food, the beer tastes better when you play that time of day. It's like, why would you ever...
Beer's hard to drink early in the morning.
This is true. Some people do.
I found that out.
I look at these places, and it pains me, because I know with not much work, you know, some paint and some a little bit of love in with the grass, it could be so much better. But I'm just kind of over... the whole clubby vibe of places. Even though clubs have gotten, for the most part, a little more relaxed and more enjoyable places, there's still an element where you just feel, and I know all the etiquette, I know how to behave,
sure.
I don't go to these places and get out of the car like Rodney and start, you know, going, "Wang, it's a parking lot," and making fun of guys' hats. Yeah, I know how to play the game, but I ultimately find it's work. It's not relaxing, it's not fun, and if it's not relaxing and fun, then what's kind of the point is where I'm at.
Well, I think, I agree with you, and I
so
think...
Really, so the final thing, so the only place I really play golf during the course of the year is Scotland, when I go there for the British Open. That's where I play most of my golf. I play very little here.
Well, you're very lucky. I think that's
the
best golf
in
the world.
And I view myself as, it's the gift of the job, and what I do is that's the privilege is that, 6:30, 7 o'clock, good. Get to go out and play a cool links course. We've watched the guys, and now we're going to go do that and play 7 or 8 holes and have fun. So that's kind of where I'm at. I don't like it. I don't like being at that place because I feel like it's a little bit negative. Part of it's where we live here in L.A. There's just not a lot of great public golf, I don't like having that sort of relationship with the sport, but to the point I was saying about new golfers, a lot of different ways to play the game and enjoy the game, and you don't have to have a handicap and have to do this and check off all these boxes for it to love the sport and love being around it.
What you just said makes me think three things. Number one, I'll play Holmby Hills. I need 10 minutes notice. Text me, I'm down. I'll come play anytime.
All right, beautiful. And great place for money games, as you can imagine. Fun,
I'm not a big money player, but I'll do it with you. I'll lose money to
like
you.
Like a dollar three ways kind
That's
of
great.
Stuff here.
I would love this. Right, this I can get down with. Two, no disrespect to any of my friends who are members at clubs all around the world, but I agree with you, and I think one of the things that happens at a club is you lose touch with public golf.
Yeah. You do.
You lose touch with the world of golfers that are new. I think we as golfers, I've never heard it said so well, the idea you're a golfer now. And I think one of the things that we as senior golfers, as the elder golfer statesmen and women, we literally give zero fucks about the new person. And we don't put our hand out and we don't say, "Hey, welcome to the game. It's good to have you."
No.
Whereas any other self-sustaining enterprise... entity, business league, men's club, women's club, whatever it is, we care about the newcomer.
Right.
And we have dropped that ball in a huge way. And I'm here to basically try to turn that around.
Good.
And then the third thing is, I can't remember.
Well, and to your point, you know, a lot of people who take up golf, it's a solitary pursuit in a lot of ways. And so I understand the people who don't want to be coddled and they like a place where they can just go out in the afternoon. Yeah, the VA course is great for that.
Yes, I still haven't played there.
Oh, geez. Oh, boy. I played there with Lloyd Cole. He's a singer, songwriter, he's from England and a passionate golfer. I took him up there, and yeah, it's in terrible shape. We had a great time. We had fun. But it is the kind of place where you can go, because golf needs places where, again, to work out the kinks when you're trying to get this thing figured out. And so that's why it's important when we talk about the Goat Hills and the Winter Parks, or trying to get these LA city courses a little bit better, that the vibe is a little more inviting. Like, I go hit balls at Rancho sometimes, and all the high school teams are there, and I just cringe, because look, the kids can make a lot out of very little, but my God, you got to have a little atmosphere, a little sense that people are trying to care about this place, or else they're going to look at this sport and go, like, this is the sport of a lifetime for me, really? This place is, like, depressing and pathetic. And so that's why it's important to get these places better. The other point, though, I was going to say, when you said that about clubs, when they lose touch with kind of the public game and the everyday game, they also lose a little bit of sense of humor.
Sure. Yeah, everything's very serious. Turn your hat around. Your hat around. From the other fairway. Eric, turn it around.
Yeah, and I get some of that etiquette stuff, fine, whatever. But some of it is, again, it's just a very hard sport. It's an expensive sport. It's a lot of different things. And those little things that make it just that much more uncomfortable for people, I just loathe. And so that's what's fun about kind of the movements we're seeing, where more and more people will tell you that their most memorable rounds of golf are at a place where, yeah, the course was good, it was okay, or it's not a masterpiece, but God, it's just such a great place to hang out after the round, or everybody there's so happy. Yeah, I hear that about Jeff Ogilvie was telling me about that. He went over to it was last year during the Torrey Pines tournament, the Farmers Open. And he's like, people are like two fairways over, and they don't know me, and I don't know them. And they just give you a quick wave. Like, you go to clubs, and they're it's
no
just
waving.
Shocking how many everybody's so miserable, or pretend, or they just don't look like they're having fun. And you don't have to be running around, and you know, again, it doesn't have to be Rodney with the music playing out of the golf bag, but you should be pretty happy that you're at that kind of a place in life, that you're at this beautiful place. It's beautifully maintained, and it's just amazing to me how many people don't look that way.
Well, let me put it to you then. Have you waved to someone from another fairway?
I always do.
You do? You really do?
I always do.
I do.
If I see people and they see
anybody.
Me, I give them
idea who they are, right?
Just a quick hey. You know, like, hey, we're all out here. Like,
the amount of no reply visually is kind of shocking.
It's weird.
I remember
it's
the last thing I was going to say before. The third point was that, you know, you talked about being remiss that we don't have Winter Park, Goat Hill. And my first thought is, well, you and I are on a bench right here, and something that probably this might not be it, but there are options for that to be created in Los Angeles. And my thought is, we're at the front of the line. We're at literally in row one of whatever is going to happen. So I think that responsibility for that needs to come back to you and me and whoever else is listening that has $100 million or any. But you know what I mean? Seriously, like, and Evan and I, my partner, we are very interested in turning that into a reality in some way. And I think, you know, that is in some ways. I was talking actually to my friends over at No Laying Up the other night when we were together, and he said, what's a success for you? And I thought, oh, I mean, a lot of things. I mean, right? Like, but aside from like content and business, the thing that I would really care about, and you talked about this, or actually no, Jack Nicklaus said it. He said, course design is about leaving a legacy. Have you heard him say that?
Yeah.
And so I realized that I'm not an architect, but I am a person that's very interested in my people, my sociology, my golfers. And so for me, I'm not going to design a golf course, but I would love to create a way for new people to go play golf. And it might not be right here, but there are a lot of opportunities for that in LA. And so I would look to you as a, you know, colleague in that.
Well, absolutely. And I think that it's not just the golf course design. There's the experience. There's so many elements to it. The programming at a place. The things like Matt Janelle every Fridays now pimping a skins game Friday afternoon. That's great.
You know, it's
just
cool.
Trying to get different people out there. There might be somebody who watches him on TV. It's like, oh, great, I get to go play with Matt Janelle, and they do it. And so the programming, the vibe of a place is everything, and there's so much opportunity there. And that's why what John's doing at Goat Hill is so fun, because he's doing some, putting some different twists, trying to get the course, again, learning from Scotland, to be a place that's in the community.
You know,
it's not, we're not fencing off. And, you know, that's why I got mad with, like, Malcolm Gladwell's whole, when he kind of took aim at golf.
Thank you for dialing him back. You know, as soon as I heard that.
I don't know if I dialed him back.
You at least threw a punch. Nobody else threw a fucking punch.
Well, it bothered me because he was missing a few key points.
Yeah.
And
he even admitted to, what's it called? When you make a title, clickbait.
Yeah.
He admitted to that.
Mm. Yeah.
Anyway, so thank you. But
well, and it. I mean, I'm certainly not going to defend some of the things golf does or ignores, but he kind of went. He went after clubs in the wrong way. Like, hey, you know what? If a group of people have a club and that's their property, they don't need to open the doors for you to go jogging. That said, we do have these amazing public golf courses and a park like this. I mean, this place is so cool because it's a park. There's a golf course. That we do need to be better maintaining and presenting. And you might actually enjoy jogging around or through those too. And so trying to get that message to people. But so much of it is the battle is now going to be, you know, golf has a stigma it's always had. Trump has added another element to it. And then just kind of, I think, shift in tastes and generations still looks at golf certain ways that we're going to have to overcome. But I mean, like this, I see a kid over here with a soccer ball, you know, the adding foot golf. One day I drove by Rancho Par 3 and there was a group of Hasidic Jews playing foot golf on the Rancho Par 3 course. And I'm so mad I did not pull over and go get photographs. I mean, but it was like, now there's probably a group of people who 10 years ago, 5 years ago said, golf's just obnoxious. But here they could play this thing they liked that was basically soccer on a golf course. They were having a great time, and that changed their view of golf.
Yeah.
And that place was more functional as a facility because it opened its door to a few more people. And, you know, maybe there should be some golf courses that aren't open on Sundays, like the old course, and it's a place where people go and they, you know, they picnic and bring the dogs, and it's a different kind of thing. So we have to be open to that kind of stuff. And it all goes back to Scotland. It's all done right there. The clubs are right there. They're open. You know, every golf course can be played there, even the most private ones. You have to write a letter and all that stuff. But the model's all right there. Now, it's not doing so well over there. There either, but there's some other forces there that are different than ours.
Bigger discussion.
Yeah.
Next podcast, let's do it in Scotland.
Oh, that would be nice. Yeah,
let's come up with a syllabus and a plan. We'll bring back enough divots to make a new course in LA.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I would love to try that. Bring back the divot, just see what happens if it grows. Yeah.
Thank you for your time, Jeff.
All right.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Eric. Appreciate it. Yeah.
Handshake.
Absolutely. Yeah.
On the picnic bench.
It's okay.
Thanks.
with Candy Spelling overseeing us.
Yeah,
here.
This is an expensive bench. Have a great week, everybody. Thanks for listening.